There's a character in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy called Slarty Bartfast.
Whose name is not important.
He was part of the Magrathean planet-building team. He liked coastlines and won an award for his work on the Norwegian fjords. Slarty Bartfast was a very literal world-builder, but in this edition of the Writer's Gym podcast with Emily Inkpen and Rachel Knightley, we're going to be talking about world-building for writers. Welcome to the Writer's Gym. The Writer's Gym podcast. Build creative confidence and grow your writing life with Rachel Knightley and Emily Inkpen.
Hello.
Hello.
Now, Emily.
Yes.
World building.
Indeed.
Is a term we hear a lot.
Yes.
Especially in relation to science fiction and fantasy writing. Can you kick off the show with your definition of the term world building, please?
Sure. Okay, so the way I see this is that world building is the process of building your stage upon which the story plays out, which is quite a basic way of putting it. The task of building it can be simple or complicated. Worlds can be vast and incalculable. They can be single spaceships. They can be an entire galaxy. And it pretty much always takes more than a week to build a world, I think. Or 6 days plus a day off, I think, yes.
As was the original business plan, I believe.
Absolutely, yes. But it almost always takes more time than this, I think, is an important thing to say.
Yes.
Yeah, we will expand on that a lot more.
But we have to do the other obvious Douglas Adams quote there, don't we? Or somebody should fine us.
Yeah.
In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and been widely held as a bad move.
Excellent.
Yes.
Now, Rachel, I mentioned that the term world building is probably most commonly associated with science fiction and fantasy writers. But is world building something that is exclusive to genre fiction in that sort of way?
God, no. We all build our own worlds every day. I think the only difference between fiction and reality is in fiction we spot ourselves doing it.
Mm.
The first noticeable world building I remember doing was when I was dared by my now partner to write a horror story at a time when I thought I didn't like horror, which is deeply embarrassing given that I loved gothic fiction. I loved all things ghost story. I just hadn't noticed that horror wasn't only people's limbs falling off, for which I apologise to the universe. But in that first horror story, I took a pub in Richmond that does exist. I had a main character go down a staircase that they would never have gone down for reasons of gender, because it's the way to the ladies' loos, and I used that for something spooky happening.
Mm.
And then I, without it being particularly conscious, went, oh, this works, and just started tearing up the geography in my head, sewing it together a different way. And what you're doing physically in place with that, you're allowing yourself access to all these different bits of your writer's artist palette, memory, imagination, observations about the world, questions about the world and your place in it. You're giving yourself wider, freer access to that. You are absolutely world building from all the places that you've ever been, from all the people and mm-hmm. the way that place and people interact. So yeah, you're doing it all of the time. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, absolutely. we're going to think of more techniques for world building in fiction through this podcast. But Emily, I want to ask you, in your writing, what comes first? Is it the world or is it the story?
It's the characters first.
So neither then?
Neither of those first. Well, I would say characters first, but they sort of feed into everything and then everything comes together like a big glorious mess.
Mm.
I mean, characters, it's how they relate to the world around them, and that in turn shapes the world. So I'm always aware that if you world build much up front, you're in danger of letting the geography steer the plot rather than your characters. And there's a lot of really cool places in my world. Why are my characters going to Yagandaath? Because it's cool? Nope, not a good reason. Your characters take steps that cause ripples. I said this, I think, last time, where your characters take steps and the ripples spread beyond where they go, and beyond where the ripples go, no one cares. Your character is at the centre. you need details to a point.
Mm. So Emily was referring there to last week's podcast, which was about place, and we specifically talked about Wessex in Thomas Hardy's novels.
Mm.
So, Rachel, why is the richness of worlds in which our stories are set so important?
I think it's one of the most important things when it doesn't overshadow. The problem that we can get is when we are so aware of place that we lose the sense of who we're seeing it through. We can't operate outside of a world. There is no character without a world that they are in. I think what can happen, particularly when writers are new, is that they can slightly hide behind telling us exactly what shade the walls were, what the number on the house was, and it can get a bit estate agent-y, which is like the place equivalent of an out-of-body experience, that it's not coming through the character. So my question to myself after the first draft, because obviously share everything with yourself that you possibly can at first, don't get me wrong, get all of that out there.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you're making it be the book, story, or whatever it is that you want it to be, that's when world building becomes part of what the character's journey is, what is going to change as a result of that story. That for me is the line in the sand between estate agency and writing and literature.
Mm. Mm.
I think that's a really good distinction, actually. Emily, I mean, I probably will come to you a bit more in this podcast because you have built a world.
A big world, yes.
A big
yes.
world.
Complicated
and
world, yes.
One of my first kind of realisations of the size of this world was when we started to work together on the audio drama, The Dex Legacy, which is set in a world that is also the world of your trilogy
Books,
novels. And more in what we sometimes term the Emily Inkpen cinematic universe.
I think that's more something you call it than me. But
it's a me thing.
Just for the record.
It's me trying to be vaguely funny, I think. But I remember that when we were getting ready to record, we briefed the actors on the world. And first of all, why did we do that? Why was it important for the actors who, I guess, are telling the story to know about that world? And then the fact that it wasn't just the geography, it was much wider than that, that we briefed them on. So can you say a little bit about that, please?
I'm going to start on geography there
mm.
and then talk about why it's important for the actors to know this stuff.
Mm.
So geography is just one thing in a world. How geography shapes people, that's where it gets interesting. So, yes, when briefing actors about where their character comes from, political systems, alliances, socioeconomic histories all feed into it. There's a country that I can use as a great example of this. So there's a place in my world, SP714, called Chakri. And the country of Chakri was geographically blessed because it bordered a mountain range, which was rich in gold and minerals. And just off the coast, there were large flat islands, which were basically on a bed of diamonds. So central tectonic plate stuff. And this meant that they were very rich as a country compared to the rest of the world. And when I created Chakri, I kind of wanted there to be a country in my world that was based on romantic notions of kings and queens and shining castles and knights. And I thought, how would that come about? And then how would it fall down? Because this is me and everything's dark and a little bit miserable. So how would this shining place cease to exist? And so this country got complacent in its wealth. And then North Jakra invaded and stripped it of its riches and used those riches to boost their own exploitative economic interests. In contrast to this, on the other side of the mountains, Eterra is pretty poor. With their wealth from the mountains, the Chakrans built a wall and they declared that the border. They built this wall halfway up the mountains and said, okay, this from here is ours. And it was really to protect the mines and their wealth and keep Eterrans out. But in doing that, they displaced a whole bunch of people. And these conflicts around this wall are still ongoing, like 1,000 years later. Eterra, in comparison to Chakri, Eterra is a strict democracy. And all of this, I came up with a saying on this continent that Jakra wants it, Aterra votes for it, Dos prays for it, and Chakri already has it. And this sort of summarizes the kind of people and the way people view these different countries and these different nations. And obviously there's some, you know, racist stuff going in there. And it really affects things. Chakri, when the Dex Legacy is happening, is no longer a country. It was invaded a long time ago. It was consumed by North Jakra. But Chakran identity related to, they already have it. And this fallen nation that has been, you know, robbed of its riches. But, you know, it's all kind of complicated. And actors need to know that the characters they come from, you know, like if they came from a country that might make people treat them differently or might make them carry themselves differently. And they need to know how relevant or irrelevant those issues are and how unfair they'd find passing comments as and when they arise in the piece. Like if somebody makes, for instance, Chakri no longer exists, if someone says something to a Chakran-born person about them being rich and snobby and the person's like, well, we don't have any wealth anymore, like we don't have that, you know, it wouldn't be a laughing matter to them. That would be deeply hurtful and, you know, wounding. So place is incredibly important, and giving actors a solid foundation on which to stand is vital. Even if they don't remember the details, they'll take on board the emotional and relevant points, and everything will feed their performance. So as a writer, I know what's relevant to the character. The actor will know what's relevant to the performance. So yes. I give them that, they take from it this, and we get something that is consistent with the world. Yeah.
What a great answer. And I think that would equally be true of characters in a novel. We need to tell the reader enough information about the background, their background, socioeconomic and whatever, that explains the way they are.
Yeah, I mean, this sort of Chakri historic example plays into a relationship that is key throughout the books. It's really underpins their relationship. It's very hostile. They do not like each other. The hostility comes from assumptions that one of the characters has made about the other. And those assumptions are unfair. But this character has been nasty enough to this, you know, to the other, to warrant just constant animosity. But it's come from this history. In this world. And
And exactly the same happens in our world.
Exactly. It's everywhere.
So Rachel, I want to kind of move this on to offering advice on world building to our listeners. When a new writer or a writer may start to think about creating a world for their characters, what are the first things they need to consider, do you think?
The first thing for me always is what matters to a character. I'm not saying everyone has to go in like this, but you've probably got a character journey in your head, in which case, what is it and what is required for it to be relevant in this world? And maybe note those things down for yourself. If, on the other hand, you are somebody who sees the world first and the character second, which neither of us do, but these people do exist, potentially. I don't know if I've met them, but I think they exist. In that case, again, it's what is it about this world that fascinates you, that preys on your mind? And you won't just have beauty, you'll have conflict, you'll have a what if, you'll have what's going to go wrong or is already subtly going wrong, and what's it going to do to a person who lives in that world. And that world could be a planet, it could be a city, it could be a house, it could be the top flat of a house, and the neighbours downstairs. World building is not only science fiction, it's existential threat in a perfectly natural place. We all live with it, both literally the what ifs that are planetary or societal and the what ifs that are personal. Know what they are, know how they manifest themselves, and then let your character go through hell in order to grow.
Yes,
because that's what the world is there for us to do in.
Yeah, and don't be afraid. If you feel like, sometimes I feel like if you're getting to a point and you want to jump scene because you're getting uncomfortable. Question why you're getting uncomfortable.
With that, something I do to refresh myself and to get closer to the world that the scene is inhabiting is if I'm just feeling a little bit stale where I am, I will go and write the same scene from another character's point of view. Even if I know perfectly well they're never going to be the point of view character, it allows me to see the room from a different angle. It allows me to see the world from a different angle. It allows me to see my protagonist from the outside. You're going to get a double negative now. Don't know what you're going to do about it. I never don't learn something from that.
Yep.
Right. Which means you do learn.
Yes.
Well, if you want to get technical about it, yes,
yes.
It does.
Yes.
Excellent.
Can I just quote Alan Bennett's version of Wind in the Willows on that, just to save my honour? Teach them, Badger. The word is teach them. Nope. The time for teaching them is over. We want to learn them.
Yes.
Which is a wholly stronger sentiment.
Wholly stronger misuse of language in order to clarify meaning, which I would argue is the reason all writers turn up.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, yep. Indeed. So, Emily, I was going to say follow that, but I'm not sure that it is possible to follow that. But
so much profundity from Badger.
And yeah. Alan Bennett and Wind in the Willows.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But Emily, let's take world building a bit further and use it to add colour and mood and all that sort of thing to our world, to our fictional world.
Yep.
What other things might we consider?
Okay, so one of the things that I really enjoy is languages. So Le Guin said that most invented languages begin with invented names. And that is often correct. And I sort of work on a geographical basis and apply phonetics. So in Chakri, which is this very gilt, gold, highly decorated world of castles and everything, they use all of the thes and shes, and their j's are soft, so they are yz. And the sounds are quite complicated. You know, their phonetic sounds are never simple. In Jakra, their j's are hard, but in North Jakra especially, they're very Chakran with their thes and shes. So their words tend to be quite long, and, you know, there's a mountain called Gestavinya and Venish Therin and all of these places that are very sort of, you know, fussy, really. I call them fussy words. In Aterra, there are no complex sounds, so a letter is a letter, and that's that to them. In Dos, their pronunciations are all at the back of the throat, so lots of k's and throaty r's. And my aim, generally speaking, in all of this is to make it so that when my readers read a name, they know where they're from geographically, or they know where they're connected to geographically. A lot of these details come from what I call the Y Warren. And the Y Warren is, you know, it's really a fun exercise. So it's like, I've written down a bit of an example because just keeping this somewhat focused, but our MC likes that character, but not this other one. Why? Because this character is rude to them. Why? Because they belong to a class of people who consider themselves above our MC. Why? Because that class was born on top of the hill and not at the bottom. So why does this character even know our MC? Because their family were forced to move after a political event occurred and supporters of X were turfed out by supporters of Y. Why did that happen? Yada, yada. The more you follow the Y Warren of personal relationships, the more details you uncover about the politics and the history and the interrelationships, the social kind of structures of a place. It's a really quick exercise to sort of do. You can just write it out, make a statement, why, you know, return line, answer the question, why, answer the question, you know, why.
Kind of interrogating yourself or challenging yourself to
think, you know, further, to
assess
go
your
further.
Own understanding of what you've created, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll put a reference to the Y Warren in the show notes of this, of this edition. Subscribe to The Writer's Gin by searching for us in your favourite podcast app and clicking follow, favourite or subscribe to be informed the moment we release new episodes and to have access to all our past editions. So Rachel, we touched on this a little bit in in the last podcast of this difference between what we'd call world building, where we're creating a world from scratch, as it were, and using place that we may have taken a few liberties with from our own world and setting our stories there. Could you give us a bit more of a definition of what the differences are between the two, please?
See, as somebody who works with creative writers to build creative confidence and realise that the answer they come out with is not going to be the same as the next writer comes out with, I'd rather not define it. Mm. I'd rather say, use the exercises, use the skills, and see where those lines are for you. I know where they are for me, but I also know that that might be very different to somebody who is more place and setting orientated or more comfortable there and less into the psychology side. The way you get into your story is no better or worse than anybody else's. The question is what you do with it once you're in there. If you see it as world building, or if you see it as place and setting, it's still there to serve a purpose, which is a change. A story is satisfying because something happens because we go through it. So some character, something changes. And usually what happens to one person does have an imprint on their community, their society, their world. So it's a circle. All of these things connect to all of those other things. The question, and that why Warren is a great place to ask this question, mm-hmm. is what does my character learn about the world? How does my story teach it to them?
Mm. Uh-huh. It's another layer, isn't it, to the why Warren that we might well use as we're planning and writing our fiction. And another phrase that I've heard used is this, building a world out of walls. Emily, where does that come from? And what do you think it means?
Okay, so basically this, I wrote a bit of a thing about this historically. Building a world out of walls comes from the opening sentence of Ursula Le Guin's The Dispossessed, which is, there was a wall. It did not look important. And she then goes on to explain the concept of wall and why walls are the most fundamental aspect of our world. Mm. And you walk away from that one paragraph, never looking at a wall in the same way ever again. It's just casual genius. I sort of taken this wisdom and I've applied it to world building in a very, you know, my own world building practices. Basically, it's an exercise of working out where a wall is, whether it's in your mind or whether it's physical, or your character's mind or whether it's in their physical world. And what is inside this wall and what is outside this wall? And does the character consider themselves to be inside or outside? Because that's also important. Are the walls there to protect or to simply form a barrier? That's also important. So working out what makes up a domestic life in your world is fundamental. Like finding that boundary between what is considered normal and not normal is key to work out what's inside and what's outside. From that point, you can work out which side of the wall you want your character to be on, or which side of the wall you want your reader to think is the right side of the wall. And then knowing this makes the difference between citizens and outcasts, and between the privileged and the deprived, and what makes domestic walls on one side of a border versus the other side could be used to emphasise the difference between cultures. And world building begins in the home, basically. So start there. Where are the walls in their heads? And where are the walls in their worlds?
Yeah.
Where is home and what's trying to get in through those walls?
Exactly. Mm. And why don't you want it to?
No, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because most stories have at some point something that a character needs to overcome.
Yes.
A challenge they need to face.
Yes.
Or some sort of journey they go on. And the walls are the restrictions that the character meets. And if we think about our own world, there are all sorts of walls, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, in the days before easy access to plane travel and boat travel, a river or an ocean, a sea
could be a wall. Yeah.
And you know, many of our fantasy or sci-fi worlds may have that low level of tech that people can't easily travel. So I think that's a really interesting definition. It's the restrictions, but also to an extent the opportunities, the protections and all of those things.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Suddenly you realise how fundamental walls are to everything. You know, the structures that we have around us and
our
minds.
Sense of identity.
Exactly, yeah. Where my wall is very different to where someone else's wall is.
So one of the questions we asked in an earlier podcast about editing was, when should you stop? When is enough editing enough editing? And I'm going to ask the question to both of you, really, probably starting with you, Rachel. In terms of world building, when have you done enough world building?
Again, my writing and editing answers would be different. When you're writing, when you're getting ideas out of your head, there's no such thing as too much because you don't know what you're looking for yet and you need to be absolutely free to get it all out. So that's the thing I'd want to say before I say anything that seems to contradict it. Like, if the world building becomes more obvious than the plot or story, then it's not really a story. So much.
It's a travel guide.
It's travel writing or estate agency or any of those things. And if that's what you're doing, by all means go and do it, but be aware of what you're doing.
I could write the spotter's guide to SP714.
Right, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But none of my characters are that interested in ornithology. Really?
Yeah. Although, you know, if it was a sort of a Kickstarter campaign and that was one of the perks that supporters got, glorious,
yeah.
But it's not instead of the actual novels.
Yeah.
Yes. I remember I'm on exactly that thought, actually. Philip Pullman did a couple of little books, one of which was called Lyra's Oxford.
Yes.
And they were like little bonus books that... and there was a bit of a story going through it, but... Yeah. So it is that spotter's guide, isn't it?
Yeah.
And the other thing to note about that is not to think that if you don't give all the world building the energy that the world won't come across. I have candles by a company now defunct, so I'll name them because they were brilliant, called Literati and Light. I have a Wonderland candle. I have a Narnia candle. Yep. Don't think that the place itself isn't coming across just because you're prioritising the story that takes place in it.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
For me, it's like the important thing is, do your characters feel well contextualized? Are they reacting to issues based on wider issues that you know about? Are those wider issues informing how others interact with them? And then you know you're pretty much there. As long as you have that bedrock, then you have context. And then as soon as you have context, you have continuity.
Well, one of the things that I love in a book, particularly a sci-fi or a fantasy book, is a map.
Oh, yes.
And I always think, if I open the first couple of pages of a book and find a map, I kind of know I'm going to love that book. And I remember opening up the first edition of The Lord of the Rings that I had and seeing that classic map of Middle-earth. And Emily, I know that you have a map of your world, don't you?
I do, yes. It's a beautiful map. I did not draw it myself. A friend of mine is actually a very talented...
We should name them.
Oh, Dewey Hargreaves.
Yeah.
He's a very talented fantasy and sci-fi map cartographer and works with authors to create maps of their worlds and do a beautiful job of it. And I commissioned Dewey to do a map of mine, and it is wonderful. And I love a good map as well. My favourite fantasy map is Earthsea, which is an archipelago. So you've got all of these islands.
Back to Le Guin again.
Amazing names for all of these islands and all of these, like, you know, ocean straits and seas and all of these things. And it's just delicious. Yeah.
So, as always, we will put links in the show notes to Dewey and his map building service, as it were.
Oh, yeah.
Where can people see the map that you refer to of SP714?
Ah, that's on the website. So www.thedexlegacy.com. There is a about page, it will be now. I'm currently doing a website overhaul. So yes, there will be an about the Dex Legacy page. and there you'll have the map and you can find it. It's also in the front of the Season 1 Collected Scripts and Commentary book, which is available on Amazon.
Good plug.
So that one is, you know, it's actually doing what, you know, a book and a book map needs to do. It's right at the front of the book. There is the map.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Rachel, are you a lover of maps in books as well?
I was just thinking, I have under my desk in the bedroom a map of Ankh-Morpork.
Oh, yes.
Which was in the production that I did to raise money for Macmillan Cancer Support in memory of my friend when I quit copywriting at 25 and formed a theatre company to raise money for her chosen charity in her memory, and from there realised I wanted to be back directing and helping writers, and sort of that was how I came back here. That map was taken from a Discworld book and colourised by Jude Claiborne, and I have that. And I also have an Ankh-Morpork City Watch badge still in my desk that were both props from the same show.
Nice.
So I have my worlds around me too.
I think this is just a map appreciation society. Wherein I also have a theory that any movie or show that has a map sequence is a superior movie or show with a map sequence, as shown by the Indiana Jones movies. And all sorts of very good high quality cinema that any movie with a map sequence is a better movie for having the map sequence is my theory.
Indeed. So I'm going to invite sort of final thoughts on world building, if either of you have them, and that can take the form of a comment, a thought, something you forgot to say earlier, or a tip for our listeners.
Here's an idea you to get you doing a little bit more of your own worlds. What are the things about it that make it perfect? And what are the things that make it dystopic?
That's a very good exercise.
Yeah.
Because just like any other place, real or otherwise, there will be things that make it more wonderful than anywhere else and more things that make it more terrible than anywhere else. Let that feed your imagination and what the conflicts of the story and the character's evolution might be.
Dex Island is like that. In the Dex Legacy, it's a horrific place, but for some people, it's pretty good. You know,
got some lovely beaches.
Got some really lovely beaches.
Yeah.
The education is fantastic. The healthcare is fantastic, with some footnotes. But you know, like generally speaking, they look after their people until they don't. Anyway, one thing I would say is that one pet peeve of mine, I'll start with this, is planets that are one thing. Planets that are countries. So a desert planet, a water planet, a forest planet. You are not describing a planet, you are describing a country. You are describing a single geographic region. And then, in effect, space becomes the ocean that you have to cross to get to the other country.
That was
the
very
other
much
region.
A Star Trek trope, wasn't
Star
it?
Star Trek trope, it's in all of them. It's the thing is that we know our planet Earth, it's incredibly varied. We've got all sorts going on in it. The best sci-fi, I think, has multiple cultures. Even if you don't see those cultures, you hear about them. And world building, get complicated. Even if it's just two countries. Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin. Two different cultures, societies.
Yes.
That's all you needed in that book to show differences in how people live in a single sort of climate and area with, you know, when faced with similar sort of geographical problems. Make your worlds a bit more interesting than one people, one language, one feature.
Yes.
Nuance. Add things. More.
I mean, even Slarty Bartfast wasn't perfect because he tried to recreate his work on Norway when he was given Australia to build.
He did and win an award.
Of course,
for
he did it with fjords.
Fair. Yeah.
And they didn't really want that.
Fjords do lend a lovely Baroque feel to a continent.
Yes, of course.
But they fell out of fashion, you see.
They did. So, Rachel, do you have an exercise?
I just want to sit here and defend Star Trek.
By all means.
I don't think my mind has now taken in anything else since that moment.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Everything else about Star Trek does
bring up a concept that may or may not be relevant, and I probably won't know until I share it with you. what Star Trek did at the time was take very fundamental premises and argue them clearly at a time when politically the things they were talking about were not talked about.
Mm.
One of which, very famously, was racism, mm-hmm. that Kirk and his crew did not understand why these two identical-looking aliens were fighting until one of the aliens said, "Well, it's perfectly obvious. The right side of my face is white, the left side of his face is." And this was the racial conflict on their planet. And for me, world building is as successful as it is relevant. I'm probably the other end of the spectrum in terms of maps in that respect, in that I feel a little bit more put off if I think I need to remember where everything is. I want the story to take me there. So although I enjoy maps, they're certainly not a necessity for me. Mm. I want to be taken by the story. So for me, it's all about knowing what you're doing there narrative-wise, what this world is speaking about, and allowing that story to be carried by the world and not the other way around.
Mm. I would also like to just add, I thought of a glorious map that I saw. Sorry.
That's all right.
I do just need to bring up this map. Yeah. It was a map of Europe with a line roughly through the middle of it, and the top was potato Europe and the bottom was tomato Europe.
Yes.
And it was actually quite an incredibly accurate map. And I think that if you can draw a line across your map with such clarity, that I think you're doing pretty well. So arbitrary and yet so true.
Yeah. Well, we didn't really talk about food in our world building, but that's a great example of, you know, if you were to find one defining feature of northern southern Europe, that might well be the one you'd go for.
Yep.
One more cultural thing. You have never experienced Shakespeare until you have read it in the original Klingon, was one of the lines from Star Trek VI, because every culture claims to have invented all the best stuff. And what I love about Star Trek was it plotted out a universe where it made me absolutely clear on what it was to be human and what the dangers of being human are. Mm. That's one, for me, of the most successful worlds ever built.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. And so much of it, as you were saying earlier, were proxies for things that were going on.
Politically, socially, emotionally, it was the most emotionally intelligent science fiction that could ever have been imagined at the time, and we owe a lot of what we enjoy now to it.
Rachel, next time we'll talk about Stargate.
Oh, well, or or not. So, at the end of this brief look at world building, I'd like to say thank you, as usual, to Rachel Knightley and to Emily Inkpen.
And to Chris Gregory.
Oh, thank you, of course.
Thank you very much, both.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Writer's Gym podcast with Rachel Knightley, Emily Inkpen, and me, Chris Gregory. If you'd like to learn more about Rachel and the Writer's Gym, please go to rachelknightley.com. To find out more about Emily, please go to emilyinkpen.com. And for Chris, go to alternativestories.com. We'll print all these links and more in the show notes for this podcast. The Writer's Gym podcast is an Alternative Stories 2024 production for The Writer's Gym. Production, sound design, and editing were by me, Chris Gregory.